Today, I would like to explore with you the possibilities and the limits of forgiveness. Forgiveness is a concept and a practice central to all the world's religions. From the Hebrew scriptures, we hear, "He hath shewed me, O man, what is good, and what doth the Lord require of me, but to do justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God." From the Christian scriptures, we hear Jesus say, "Ye have heard that it hath been said, Thou shalt love thy neighbour and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you." And from the Quran, the Muslim scriptures, we hear, "Repair the evil done to you with something that is better, and lo, the enemy who did evil to you may turn into a close and true friend." Forgiveness has become a virtue, a highly desired but little achieved virtue in the secular humanist world as well. All of us, religious or otherwise, see forgiveness mostly as a virtue that we may aspire to, yet feel we lack the necessary material to achieve somehow. Forgiveness is seen, I think, as a noble, yet so often unattainable goal. It seems that it is the stuff of the gods, something ethereal and pure, that our all too human feelings of hurt and disappointment, betrayal and revenge, spite and remorse, prevent us from coming anywhere near reaching. Yet, of course, all of us know of remarkable stories of forgiveness. Forgiveness against all the odds. Perhaps we ourselves have been forgiven against all odds. Or perhaps, more likely, we've seen these things at a distance. The English word forgive is comprised of two parts, the first of which, for, is taken from ancient English and means away. Our word forget is of similar origin. It is like forgo, which means to relinquish, to give up, to do without, to forbear the use or advantage of, the forgiving of a debt. It is not without emphasis that the Lord's Prayer, the prayer that Jesus taught, is often translated as, "Forgive us our debts," instead of sins or transgressions. Sin, of course, is that which separates, which is why it needs to be overcome in order to restore harmony. There are in all three Hebrew words and three Greek words in the Bible that have been translated to the English word forgive. The Hebrew words are kapha, to cover, nasa, to lift up, and salak, to send away or let go. The Greek words are apoluo, to loose away, charismoi, to be gracious to or merciful to, and aphemi, to send away or let off. So to forgive is to let go of a transgression, to send it away, to loose the cords that bind the sin to the sinner, as the lovely original Aramaic version of the Lord's Prayer translates. It is to allow for a future between the victim and the perpetrator, to give a clean slate for such a future, to give acceptance for the future of a relationship, to cease holding a past misdeed against somebody. It is a remembering and an acknowledging. It is then a letting go. Letting go so that we can move on into the future with an openness of heart. Yet can one, or should one in fact, always forgive? Is it always appropriate to let go and move forward? Are there some circumstances where we can never and perhaps should never do these things? As well as the undoubted possibilities that forgiveness offers us, does forgiveness also have its limits? Do these words from the French postmodern philosopher Jacques Derrida hold any truth for us? There is only forgiveness, if there is any, when there is the unforgivable. I'd like to explore this idea with you for the rest of the service. I would like to explore it through the story many of you may know, titled The Sunflower by Simon Wiesenthal. It is, tragically, a true story. Simon Wiesenthal was Jewish. He was imprisoned in a Nazi concentration camp in Poland. Simon lost 89 members of his family to the camps. Upon his liberation at the end of the Second World War, he joined the American Commission for War Crimes. In 1946, with 30 other concentration camp survivors, he founded the Jewish Historical Documentation Center, which functioned in the American zone until 1954 and reopened in Vienna in 1961. Its task was to identify and locate Nazi war criminals. The center's work was instrumental in bringing over 1,000 Nazi criminals to justice. Perhaps what Simon Wiesenthal was equally well known for was his account of an incident that occurred while he was still imprisoned in the camps. He was labouring one day with other Jewish prisoners when a Red Cross nurse approached him. She asked him if he was Jewish. He replied that he was. She beckoned to him and led him to an Army SS hospital. He followed her through many long corridors that led finally to a room, housing a lone man of 22 years of age. The man was bandaged from head to toe, and he was blind. He was a dying SS officer. "My name is Karl," he said. "I must tell you something dreadful, something inhuman. It happened a year ago." Karl told the horrifying story of a night when he and other SS officers trapped a Jewish family in a house and then threw grenades at the house, incinerating all who lived there. The screams and looks of terror, as many jumped from the windows, especially the children, still haunted him, he said. Before becoming involved with the SS as a teenager, Karl said that he was a committed Catholic. "I cannot die without coming clean," he said. "I know what I've told you is terrible. In the long nights while I wait death, time and time again I have longed to talk about it to a Jew and beg forgiveness from him. Only I didn't know if there were any Jews left. I know what I'm asking you is almost too much for you. But without your answer, I cannot die in peace." Simon Wiesenthal stood in silence. He remembered the family he had lost, the children he had seen and heard die, the unspeakable atrocities committed by men like Karl, and that he knew would go on being committed by men like Karl. But, he thought, here was a dying man, a murderer who did not want to be a murderer, but who had been made into a murderer by a murderous ideology. But he was confessing his crime to a man who perhaps must die at the hand of these same murderers. Simon Wiesenthal said, "Two men who had never known each other had been brought together for a few hours by fate. One asks the other for help. But the other was himself helpless and able to do nothing for him. I stood up and looked in his direction, at his folded hands. At last I made up my mind, and without a word, I left the room." Simon Wiesenthal could not offer the forgiveness the dying murderer craved. Since that day, Wiesenthal has wondered, did I do the right thing? What would you have done? Let us all now take a break and share in some extended silence. Let us ponder Simon Wiesenthal's poignant questions. Did he do the right thing? What would we have done? Did I do the right thing? What would you have done? These two questions are the pivotal theme of Simon Wiesenthal's book, The Sunflower, The Possibilities and Limits of Forgiveness. He tells the story and then invites 53 distinguished men and women to respond to those two questions. The 53 comprise theologians, political leaders, writers, jurists, psychiatrists, human rights activists, and victims of attempted genocide in Bosnia, Cambodia, China, and Tibet. They all approach the questions differently, and they challenge us to define our beliefs about justice, compassion, and human responsibility. I would like to share some of them with you. My aim is to be descriptive, not prescriptive. The responses, I think, speak for themselves. The Dalai Lama, the spiritual leader of Buddhists throughout the world, and Archbishop Desmond Tutu, chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, both advocated forgiveness. Forgiveness, whatever the crime. The Dalai Lama spoke of his Tibetan people's persecution by Chinese authorities and said, "It would be easy to become angry at these tragic events and atrocities. Labelling the Chinese as our enemies, we could self-righteously condemn them for their brutality and dismiss them as unworthy of further thought and consideration. But that is not our Buddhist way." Archbishop Tutu spoke of the magnificence of his former South African president, Nelson Mandela, who was incarcerated for 27 years. His eyesight failed through enforced work in a quarry, his family harassed by the state security police. Tutu said, "By rights, he should be consumed by bitterness and a lust for revenge. The world watched with awe when he so magnanimously invited his white jailer to his inauguration as South Africa's first democratically elected president. I could tell," Archbishop Tutu says, "of others, both black and white and less well known, who, if asked, 'What would you have done?' would have done the same. They would have forgiven. Forgiveness is not some nebulous thing. It is practical politics. Without forgiveness, there is no future." Other contributors, interestingly, were not so praiseworthy of this thing we call forgiveness. The eminent Jewish writer Cynthia Osnick says to us, "Whoever is merciful to the cruel will end up by being indifferent to the innocent. Forgiveness," she says, "can brutalize. Whoever is merciful to the cruel will end by being indifferent to the innocent." "We may object," she says, "by saying that forgiveness does not condone or excuse. It allows for redemption, for a fresh start, a clean slate. It encourages beginning again. Forgiveness, we may say, permits renewal. But only if there is a next time," she says. "I forgive you," we say, "to a child who has muddied the carpet, but next time, do not do it again." Forgiveness has enlarging capacities. It will have taught us something. Forgiveness is an effective teacher. Meanwhile, the spots can be washed away. "But murder," she says, "is irrevocable. With murder, there is no next time. Even if forgiveness restrained a person from perpetrating a new batch of corpses, the last batch will never come alive again." There are, Cynthia Osnick says, some spots forgiveness cannot wash out. Forgiveness which permits redemption can only apply to a condition that is capable of redemption. Forgiveness, she says, is pitiless. It forgets the victim. It negates the right of the victim to his own life. It blurs over suffering and death. It drowns the past. It cultivates sensitivity towards the murderer at the price of insensitivity towards the victim. Martin Marty, a professor of comparative religion at the University of Chicago, speaks of cheap grace. He says, "Is there any kind of situation in which the offence is so gross and enormous that I should withhold forgiveness in the face of what appears to be true penitence? My answer, he says, would be that in every circumstance that I can picture, more value would grow out of forgiveness than out of its withholding. But I must ask what I am afraid about, what I'm concerned about, and what it is that causes me to hem and hedge, to shuffle and clear my throat, and to be suspicious of that answer I just gave you. He starts to answer his question. Firstly, I'm afraid of cheap grace. Simon Wiesenthal's silence in that army hospital was a guard against the cheapening of grace. A second fear is that crimes against a people will be taken less seriously if individual persons start forgiving in their name. And a third reason is, if grace be cheap and splattered at random, will we not soon forget to tell the story? We do not want a cheap grace, a casual people, or a forgotten victim. What do we want? I'm in search of a grace in the world, he says. As a Christian, I'm told that God is a gracious other, but I also need to be a brother. Gracelessness helps produce totalitarians, but so too might a grace that is cheap. Rabbi Harold Kushner explores the idea of forgiveness as grace, as an undeserved gift. He says, I'm not sure there is such a thing as forgiving another person, though I know that there's such a thing as being forgiven. To be forgiven is to feel the weight of the past lifted from our shoulders, to feel the stain of past wrongdoing washed away. To be forgiven is to feel free to step into the future, unburdened by the precedent of who we have been and what we have done in previous times. To be forgiven is a miracle. It comes from God, and it comes when God chooses to grant it, not when we order it up. Forgiving is not what we do for another person, as the Nazi asked Wiesenthal to do for him. For a Jew to forgive a Nazi would not mean, God forbid, saying, what you did was understandable, I can understand what led you to do it, and I don't hate you for it. It would instead mean saying, what you did was thoroughly despicable and puts you outside the category of decent human beings. But I refuse to give you the power to define me as a victim. I refuse to let your blind hatred define the shape and content of my Jewishness. I don't hate you, I reject you. And then the Nazi would remain chained to his past and his conscience, but the Jew would walk free. Matthew Fox, the former Roman Catholic Dominican priest and a prolific writer on green spirituality, speaks quite profoundly, I think, when he says, Simon Wiesenthal did not offer the dying SS man forgiveness as a Jew. How could he forgive in the name of even one in that home of horrors, where hundreds were tortured, millions were tortured? But Simon Wiesenthal, summoned as priest confessor, let the man speak his heart. Some sins are too big for forgiveness, even for priests. Public penance is what is required. This man received no public penance, but his private penance was considerable, having to die in the silence of the truth staring him in the face. I sense in the wisdom of Simon Wiesenthal's silence, in his decision to walk out in silence, a win-win situation. Wiesenthal kept his soul, and the young soldier may have saved his soul. Not a priest offering cheap grace for unmentionable sins, but a relative of his dead victims. Call it tough love, or call it non-sentimental compassion. But Wiesenthal offered Carl a morally responsible and adult response in his silence. Be with your sin, he was saying. Be in the dark negativa where so many of your victims lie. Be where so many of your victims and their relatives lie. Listening was Wiesenthal's gift to Karl. It was his gift of compassion. This unusual gift between two young men, one a killer and the other a hunted for no other reason than his race. This touching of stories and hearts. Both were victims of older men's decision-making. But one was a perpetrator of their older man's sick vision, and the other was at the receiving end of it. This was Simon Wiesenthal's compassion, to stay and listen, and even to remain silent, and to refuse to offer cheap forgiveness for so heinous a crime. There are sins that God and not humans must forgive, and no one had anointed Simon Wiesenthal to forgive in God's name. There has been much to digest this morning. I wanted to offer you many different responses to a situation that mercifully many of us will never have to suffer or anything like it. Simon Wiesenthal's story is the most extreme of scenarios, and it requires us to really think about what we mean when we speak about forgiveness. Extreme though it may be, forgiveness, to forgive or not, is with us in all our lives, all the time. And how we deal with it determines greatly what quality of life it is that we all live. And in contemplating the extreme, we are more fully informed of what it is that we are or are not offering when we offer forgiveness or when another is offering it to us. And sadly, tragically, atrocities like those Simon Wiesenthal was subjected to continue in our world every day. Is forgiveness, that gift of grace that we are offered undeservedly, that gift that loosens the cords of our mistakes, that binds us to the past, that lifting up and sending away of our sins, is it a gift that gives us back a future, our own future, and a future with our victims? How rich are the possibilities that forgiveness offers us? Yet, does forgiveness also have its limits? Are there times when the granting of forgiveness is inauthentic, when it is nothing but cheap grace that forgets the victim at the expense, that forgets the victim at the expense of the perpetrator? Is it true that whoever is merciful to the cruel will end by being indifferent to the innocent? And is not forgiveness a sacred and valued quality only because we understand it has limits? As Jacques Derrida says, there is only forgiveness, if there is any, when there is the unforgivable. This you each must decide for yourselves. I will leave you with a medieval story. Legend has it that the apostles assembled together in heaven to re-celebrate the Last Supper. There was one place vacant until through the door Judas came in, and Christ rose and kissed him and said, "We've been waiting for you." Amen.